Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guests will be Eric Jackson and Lee Jordan. They both are working with the Black Yield Institute in Baltimore, and I will tell you more about that organization and have them come on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you things going on in and around the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first off, when it comes to taking action, there's a lot of talk about the dangers of 5G technology. Right now, the internet and our cell phones all work on 4G technology, which is faster and better than 3G was. But now the 5G that they're coming out with seems to be even more powerful, and yet it requires these small cell towers to be put up throughout neighborhoods much more, much closer to people's homes than the other cell towers. And there's a lot of concern about the safety of that, especially since the safety really hasn't been vetted out. There hasn't been enough research done to see whether these are safe. So there is an assemblyman in New York that has introduced a bill to examine 5G safety. And I have on my website at iegreen.com a way that you can participate and send a letter to your assemblyman. There's a link to find out who your assembly person is to ask them to help support this bill. But it's really important that as we move on, that we balance the benefits of technology with the safety, both for our health and the environment, and just not enough thought is put into that. And, so often it's just about the money and who's going to make the money, and they seem to be taking the lead. And so we need to stand up and let our voices be heard. Also, the issue with vaccinations, right now vaccines are required and mandated for all school children, and if you don't have a vaccination, you cannot go to school. And so many parents have had to remove their kids from school and start homeschooling. And I think it's important that everybody be able to make their own choice. And so this is a bill to bring back religious exemption. And if your spiritual beliefs are against vaccination, you should have a right to exempt your child from that vaccination. That's my belief system. I mean, everybody is entitled to their own belief system as to what they feel the benefits are of vaccinations, being able to choose vaccinations that they think are safe. But, there's a lot of question out there, and there's a lot of really good questioning going on. But to have a law that requires and mandates everybody to be vaccinated, I think, is a mistake. So this is a bill that Assemblyperson David DiPietro has brought back to restore the religious exemption from the vaccine mandates. So if you could sign on to that as well, that would be really great. And then I just wanted to share with all of you an article that was written about in the New York Times about a new city law that's going to require new buildings to be topped with green spaces or solar panels. And I was just so excited about that. I mean, I've gone to many green roofs in New York City and the suburbs, and it's just fascinating to be up in the, on the top of a building and feel like you're in the country. And to see the bees and the butterflies coming back is just heartwarming. And so it's really great to know that there's actually a law requiring that. And so I hope this is just a first step in really trying to address how cities can help not just help restore biodiversity when it comes to our pollinators, but also even taking the next step and with the solar panels or maybe photovoltaics in the windows. Could you imagine if all the glass of all the buildings in New York City were able to store energy and create their own energy to run that building? How awesome would that be? So anyway, I just encourage us all to keep dreaming on and to coming up with innovative ideas and new laws that can help make our world a little bit better as we move forward. I want to share with all of you some things going on in the New York and greater area. This Sunday, Slow Food North Shore, which is the organization that I am very involved with, they are having an Oktoberfest in November, so it's November 3rd. We just missed out on October. But at a great new brewery that just opened up in Bayville called Old Tappan Brewing Company, and it's from 4 to 7. There will be light noshes and beer flights, and hope you can join us there. Tickets will be available at the door. On November 5th, there's a wonderful forum taking place up at the University of New Hampshire, sponsored by a whole group of nonprofit organizations. NOFA New York and all the different NOFAs are part of this. And it's called the Food Solutions Forum. It's taking place at the University of New Hampshire on November 5th from 10 to 1. It's free. They have a great panel of discussions going on, and I wish I could go. I can't, but for those of you that can go, I recommend that you do. It's going to be really great. November 6th, the film Wasted is going to be screened at the Sid Jacobson Center in Roslyn, and that's November 6th at 7:30 p.m., and the film is called Wasted, the Story of Food Waste, and it's a great documentary. I've seen it before, really mind-opening. So if you can make it to that, that's great. The Northeast Sustainable Agricultural Working Group is having their It Takes a Region Conference November 7th through the 9th. And then the National Farm-Based Education Conference is coming up November 8th through the 13th. That's in Baltimore. The Northeast Sustainable Agricultural Working Group Conference is in New Jersey. All of these are on my website, so do check them out. November 9th, the 92nd Street Y is having a great food summit all day long from 10 to 5. It looks great. I'm so jealous that I can't go. But if you can go, I recommend you getting tickets. Go to the 92nd Street Y website to get tickets for that. And what else? November 14th, going back to the vaccine issue, if you are passionate about freedom to choose vaccinations, there's a big rally and walk down on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. on November 14th. And then November 20th, the Climate Wednesdays at the Brooklyn Library continue. On November 20th, the topic is Parenting in the Age of Climate Change, and that's at the Brooklyn Library from 7 to 8:30, and that's free. And then the following month, the Green New Meal will be the Climate Wednesday, and that will be the Food Climate Connection at the Brooklyn Public Library. I'll be moderating that with a great panel of colleagues, so I hope you can come to that, and tickets are also free for that. And then save the date for January 17th to 19th. NOFA New York is having their winter conference this year instead of Saratoga Springs. It will be up in Syracuse, and that's always a wonderful, wonderful conference, so I hope you can make it to that. And now I want to share with you my recipe. I know I promised you that I would give you the seitan marsala recipe, which is the entree that I make every year for Thanksgiving. However, I had leftover pumpkin from all the pumpkin soup I made last week, so I had to make pumpkin muffins. So I'm going to share with you the pumpkin muffin recipe this week, and I promise you the seitan marsala recipe for next week. So the pumpkin muffins I made are vegan and they're gluten-free. And they have a crumb topping on them, so they are just so delicious. So you're going to preheat the oven to 350. This recipe makes 3 dozen, okay, 36 muffins, but I promise you they go fast. You can certainly cut it in half if you don't want to make that many, but mine just went so fast. So anyway, I started with 2 tablespoons of ground flaxseed that I mixed with 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar and 2 tablespoons of water, and that takes the place of my egg. And helps, you know, hold everything together. And flaxseed is great for that. 2 cups of pumpkin puree, and this was fresh pumpkin puree that I made. So it sat for a while, and the water separates out of the pumpkin. So I try to drain as much of the water out of the pumpkin puree as you can before making the recipe. 1 cup of maple syrup, 1/2 cup of organic oil. I used safflower oil. You can use canola oil or coconut oil. 1 cup of applesauce. 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract. 1 tablespoon of baking powder. 2 teaspoons of salt. 2 tablespoons of baking soda. 1 teaspoon of cinnamon. 1 teaspoon of nutmeg. 1 teaspoon of allspice. 3.5 cups of your favorite gluten-free flour. 1 cup of gluten-free oats that I ground down. So I measured 1 cup after it was ground. And 1/2 cup of shredded organic coconut. And that's for the muffins. And for the topping, I used 1/4 cup of brown sugar, 1/4 cup of dairy-free flour, 1/4 cup of gluten-free oats, 3 tablespoons of organic canola oil, 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon, and 1/2 cup of pecans. So I combined the flaxseed, the apple cider vinegar, and the water in a small bowl, and I set that aside as my egg. In another bowl, I combined all the dry ingredients. In another bowl, I combined all the wet ingredients. And then I add the dry ingredients to the wet. And then I also added in the flax mixture to that, and I mixed it all up. I prepared the muffin tins with cupcake liners, and I filled them all 2/3 full. Then I sprinkled it with the crumb topping, and the crumb topping, you just mix all those things together in one bowl, and then just sprinkled the crumb topping on top. I baked it in a 350-degree oven for 10 minutes. Then I turned the pans around and did it for another 5 to 10 minutes. Depending on your oven and the heat, it was 20 minutes total. But again, just check them because you don't want to burn them. Really fast, to pull together. It's delicious. If you don't have fresh pumpkin, you can certainly use canned pumpkin. And that would just be 1 can of pumpkin, would equal the 2 cups of pumpkin puree. And that's it. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guests. Eric Jackson is an organizer, educator, and filmmaker. And he's now humbly serving as the visionary of Black Yield Institute, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to building a movement toward black land and food sovereignty in Baltimore. And, that organization is addressing a whole bunch of different issues, including food inequities, and we'll talk more about that in just a little bit when he comes on. And Lee Jordan, he is an organizer, mentor, and entrepreneur, and he began working in the community early on, starting in the middle school, and then grew into other leadership roles, captain of the men's varsity basketball team, both at the high school and the collegiate level. And he's now working with the Black Yield Institute as well. And so I'd like to introduce both of them to us now. Eric and Lee, are you with me?
Peace. This is Brother Eric. We're still I'm still waiting for Brother. He's working on a few things right now, so we'll apologize about that.
Okay, Eric. Well, we'll get started, and whenever Lee can join us, he will. So I thought maybe you could start by just sharing with my listeners the mission and the vision of the Black Yield Institute. Tell us a little bit about that organization.
Sure. Thank you, Vivani. First, thank you for the opportunity. This is a great opportunity to share with folks about Black Yield Institute. Black Yield Institute is, as you talked about, an organization that is committed to black land and food sovereignty and addressing the issue of food apartheid as it shows up in black and brown communities in Baltimore. Our vision essentially is a community, a network of communities and people and entities that actually control more of the decisions and destiny around food and land resources in communities that unfortunately experience food apartheid. So our goal really is to make changes, but also really build power, and not just about making sure people have good food, but power, because if we have power, then we can have food. But having food may not necessarily mean having the power to enact and control for generations. So that's what we're working on.
And the Black Yield Institute is, you know, is really a black organization. I know that you feel like it's really important that the black people take the lead in this work. Can you talk to us a little bit about the importance of that and the ownership that's needed to really make this change?
Absolutely. So we are a Pan-African organization. We are very clear that, one, the issues that are that we talk about when I say food apartheid, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that in comparison to other terms that your listeners and others may have heard. But for us, it's about making sure that those who are directly impacted by the issues are those at the helm of solving the problems. And we're very clear that our work has to be focused on and centered in black experiences, because in Baltimore in particular, about 86%, I think it's about 84 actually, 84% of the people who experience food insecurity are black people in Baltimore City. And so our work has to be, you know, we believe it has to be led by those who are directly and disproportionately impacted by the lack of good food and ancestral foods in our community. So we believe that not only do we need to lead this work, but we also recognize that this hasn't happened in a vacuum. It's happened historically over time, and it's not, while it should be led by black people, that non-black people, including other melanated people, people of color, and white people can support as well, because we know we're not in this by ourselves, but we have to lead it through our creative genius and through our experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's so important. I've seen, you know, as someone that's worked in a lot of with a lot of nonprofit organizations, how important it is for those that are affected by whatever the problem is that they're taking charge, because when other people from the outside come in and kind of say, we know what you need, it never works. It really needs to be, be more organic and from the a grassroots level of the people there saying, this is what we need, and then going about how to get that and make that happen.
Absolutely.
I know you're going to be presenting at the Farm-Based Education Network conference that's coming up in a couple weeks, and I was wondering if you could share with us what you will be presenting there.
Sure. So Brother Lee and I, Brother Lee is a community organizer with us, as you said. We'll be presenting a workshop that we have called like Amplifying Black Land and Food Sovereignty. So our goal is to share first with folks, and it seems like we actually had a lot of interest. So for the 25 or so folks that will come, and maybe more, we'll share. We'll start off kind of connecting with folks and connecting why we utilize the language food apartheid and why we've adopted that language to talk about the problem that we see we're facing. And then we're going to, from there, engage folks through their own personal experiences and then talk about what black land and food sovereignty is in concept, and then also what it looks like on the ground in Baltimore and what we're actually working on. So it's going to be really exciting. I'm excited to share at the conference and to share with the community of educators and practitioners, activists, organizers about the work that we're doing, and hopefully encourage folks and welcome folks to think differently about the issues. And because we're very clear that how we see the problem it will directly impact the way that we solve the problem. And so we want to, as much as we can, encourage folks to shift their lens from one of mere food access to one of the limited power, social power and political power that people have, so that when folks go back to their communities, that they can think differently about it, but also begin to make shifts in terms of how they work with the people that they serve and the people that they're in struggle with.
Mm-hmm. And is this are the workshops at the conference breakout sessions, or does everybody participate in all the different workshops?
So they're breakout sessions. We're going to be presenting that, and that's, like I said, I think right now we have something like 25 or 30 folks, at least that was the last check, that will be a part of that. But also we are privileged to have space where many people can come at the conference, because we're doing a second workshop, if you will. We're screening our film, Baltimore's Strange Fruit. And so this is a film that we made in 2018, and we are going to be sharing that film. And that film also attempts to shift the conversation from what we consider apolitical language, like food deserts and, ask, invite folks to think differently in terms of language, but also to give some historic context and contemporary context for what that looks like and the complexities thereof. The film explores redlining and other issues that are directly connected to food and land, land use in urban contexts. So we're going to talk about that, and then we're also in the film kind of, pose solutions and share what folks are actually already doing in Baltimore to address the issue. So that'll be another opportunity for folks to come to. It won't be a breakout session, so it's space for many people to come and see the film, and just share and be in community conversation once the film has, concluded.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, you've used the term already, food desert and food apartheid, and I know for many people those are different. Some people think they're the same. And I know in the work that I've done, some people have taken offense to the term food desert. They're like, our community is not a food desert. Deserts are barren, have nothing, and if you look around, there's loads of food. It just might not be the food that they want or we want.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the terms food desert versus food apartheid? What both of those terms mean to you, and then how are they different and how might they be similar?
Sure. So I'll just at least share that, the language food desert is language that seeks to identify issues around fresh food availability in communities that are based on the distance from a grocery store, the actual health food that is available, and then vehicle ownership. At least in Baltimore, those are kind of like the indicators. And so that, definitively does not include any aspect of power that relates to it being class-based, and particularly race-based and historic. And we don't demonize the term, but we say that the term is inadequate to talk about the issue, and it doesn't unfold the political underlying, issues. And so we believe that food apartheid is something that kind of gives more voice to what's actually happening. And so for us, from our standpoint, I think part of it is about changing our barometer and making sure that folks recognize that, one, deserts actually do have food. And people who live in deserts have food, and so it can be offensive to some people. And then on the other hand, from our standpoint, it's more for us to recognize that, it's really just a Pollyanna way of kind of talking about an issue that we believe that is, it makes it easier to swallow, to say, oh, well, people don't have good food, well, let's provide food. And it actually perpetuates these activities of food aid, which in our opinion is also limiting when it comes down to our goals of self-determination and creating self-determining food economies. And so in order to do that, we have to shift how we talk about it. And we know that historically and contemporarily, the people who've had limited access to good food are almost always poor or low income. They are largely black and brown people who live in these poor areas, and particularly these are experiences, not just geographical areas, but experiences that also limit people's access to culturally appropriate food. And these are foods that are specifically significant to people who are, people of color, you know, who do not have the luxury, if you will, of eating the same foods that our ancestors ate because of the Americanization of, you know, certain foods. And unfortunately, one example or one way that it shows up is that people actually get a chance to get good food, even culturally appropriate food, when it comes through the some kind of fad or what have you that typically, you know, white folks actually bring forward. So, for instance, kale, right? I remember kale being a staple during holidays and celebrations in my family and in my community. And then I get older, and then kale is deemed as a superfood by, white foodies, and now it's available everywhere. And so those kinds of nuanced ways, we want to kind of unearth them and show how racial inequities show up in the food system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's great to make people aware of that. I mean, I had no idea about kale. I mean, you hear of collard greens a lot more as, you know, Southern cooking, but not kale.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know a lot of chefs who, you know, have had to, like, redo their cookbooks because, you know, there wasn't kale salad in their cookbooks the first round because kale wasn't something people were eating. And now, you know, if you're a natural food chef and you don't have a kale salad recipe, you're deemed, not with it. So, what's your personal connection to Black land and food sovereignty work?
And this is a theme that is explored in our film. I grew up with a very strong grandmother, you know, my mother as well. Both of my parents are amazing. But my grandmother really, food was a medium of relationship building, support. In fact, living for my grandmother. My grandmother served as a maid in the homes of Jewish families in Baltimore. And so food was really, like, key to my family and to community members. And my grandmother, though, all of my life, I don't remember a time where she wasn't dealing with some health issue, and chief among them was diabetes. And so she passed when I was 14 years old, and I didn't realize until I got older how much my relationship with my, and this is my maternal grandmother, how much it really shaped who I was and how close I was to her until she passed. And then recognizing that not only did I lose her early, but the stories and lessons that I learned, you know, were really, important, you know, and I didn't have that anymore. And then also recognizing that her daughter, my mother, also dealt with, you know, many diet-related, lifestyle-related illnesses, including diabetes as well, that this was a challenge. And then I got older and I recognized that it wasn't just for my personal story, but many people who I grew up with and I knew and that I share community with were dealing with the same things. And so in my early 20s, I began making shifts, personal shifts to my diet, and I recognized it wasn't enough for me to just be able to go to Whole Foods like, you know, my counterparts in college. And so it became something that I was politicized around. And so I began organizing, and it's been something that I've been doing actively since for about 10 years, a little over 10 years, educating folks, organizing folks, and ultimately, you know, just mentoring and supporting people, recognizing that we have to change food environments and we have to build power. And so I don't want you know, at least one of the ways that food apartheid impacts families is in the way that I just talked about my grandmother. Those culture keepers and those who are to share and give us eyes into who we are dying or transitioning prematurely, and that's an issue. And so we want to make sure that that we do that work, and that's personally why I do this work. I don't want that for my children. I don't want that for anyone's children. And I want to be able to support building a future where food environments are controlled by the people who live there and not by those who have absolutely no interest in people other than what they can extract from them.
Mm-hmm. And since you've been involved in this work, have you personally seen a shift in the foods that people in your community are eating, or, you know, is it still primarily the same?
Yeah, I think I am a big, I'm not just satisfied with what we're doing. I will have to say, in all honesty, that there are different foods that are available, not just in terms of what we do, but also what people ask for. Part of that, I think, are just shifts in, you know, in what's acceptable, and, you know, health is really big. And I think we contribute to that in terms of what's available. But also, we're not satisfied with the, you know, the inundation of carry-out foods and other foods that that people actually lean on for sustenance. And we want to change that. We'll continue to change that. But we're making some strides, but there's still a whole lot more work to be done.
Yeah. And that's not just in black and brown communities. It's in the white communities, too. I mean, you know, you still see the lines out the door at McDonald's and Burger King and all those fast food places. And, you know, I wonder to myself, it's like, don't people read? Don't they know how bad this food is for them? And they keep lining up. It's just amazing. So how has your diet shifted? I know you said you made changes. Are you eating vegetarian? Are you eating plant-based? Or are you just eating cleaner, like more Mediterranean diet? How have you changed?
Yes. So largely plant-based diet. And making sure that, like, all foods, including herbs and things of that nature, that I'm making sure to give my body what it needs, and the same with my family. And those who I'm in community with, just trying to, as much as I can, share with them the knowledge that I have so that folks can be informed eaters. So my diet has shifted a bit. And it's made different changes since I was, late teens, early 20s. But largely just, like you said, eating cleaner and being more aware of what I actually get in my body. So lots of greens and beans and things like that. I eat a little more bread than I want to, a little more pasta than I should. It's just been good. It's been a good process. My goal is to be able to eat only what I grow, and that is my goal actually moving forward, my personal goal.
And so if you're looking to do that, that means that you must have access to land. Can you share with us, do you have a home garden? Are you homesteading? Where are you growing your food?
So Black Hill Institute is growing food on a previously vacant lot that was the home of, about 100 or so families in public housing in South Baltimore. So we grow on an acre and a quarter right now, with our goals of moving into another space or expanding to another 3-acre site that is adjacent to where we are. So that's where we grow for our, agriculture project. Personally, I do have access to land. My family and I are privileged to have about an acre of land in northeast Baltimore, where we haven't grown anything thus far, and part of it is just really putting a lot of energy into the work that I do here. But next year, if I have the opportunity to, come on the show again, I can share more about the pepper seeds that I've saved. So we're going to be growing some peppers and some melons. We'll be growing some cucumbers. I've saved a lot of seeds, so it's in the works. But yeah, that's where we're moving. Personally, uh-huh. that's where we're moving.
Uh-huh. Good. You know, I grow a lot of my own food, and, you know, it gives you such an appreciation for the work of farmers and the importance of growing food and how much goes into it. And, you know, when you think of, you know, talking about ancestors, I mean, their daily life was about putting food on the table, you know. That's how life used to be. It was all about preparing the food, growing the food, harvesting the food, milking the cows, churning the butter. I mean, just, you know, everything to get the food on your table required work. And now we're in a state of society where everybody wants convenience. Nobody wants to do the work. They just want to make a phone call, and, you know, they don't even want to wait a day for something to be shipped. They want something there in, you know, an hour. Everything's about convenience and immediacy. And, you know, one of the beauties about growing your own food is the process and the patience and waiting and seeing it happen. And, you know, it just makes you appreciate everything, every bite. You know, you can give thanks to who grew it and to the, you know, and if you're eating an animal, who gave their life. I mean, just what, you know, it's just completely different when you take ownership of the food you're putting into your mouth.
Exactly. And it's a different spiritual connection, too. I mean, one of the limitations of the industrial food system is, in addition to the convenience and things of that nature, is our spiritual and emotional disconnection from all of the processes and all of the people that actually feed us, you know. And so, like, to your point, that's where I personally want to go. And the reason why I would like to be there is because I really want, and as you talked about, in the little glimpses, like in the, I see from the seedling, the collard seedling, to this bustling, you know, plant, that I'm like, I know exactly what went into this. In fact, I know the groundhogs that bit into this. You know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. like, the entire process and the aphids that we had to pluck off, you know. So, like,
right.
Wanting to connect to that and do that on a more consistent basis. That's my personal goal.
And also, when you're cooking the food, I talk about this all the time, when you're cooking the food and you know that you're making this food for your family, you are not just going through the motions, but you're putting your love and energy into that food. And you talk about spiritual energy, you know, you're then giving that to your family. You know, where when you go to Burger King, there's nobody putting any spiritual energy into that food. It's a completely different thing. And so,
yeah, that's so true.
There's so much healing energy in that. So, Eric, let's take a couple-minute break. When we come back, maybe Lee will be ready to join us. If not, you and I will continue on. I have so many more questions to ask you, but first we need to take a couple-minute break. So, everyone who's listening, I'm talking with Eric Jackson from the Black Yield Institute, and you're listening to Bhavani, and we'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more news you can use on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is John Lobel. You can hear my show Visionaries at 10 a.m. on Mondays on PRN. And guess what? PRN now has its own app. So you've always been able to listen to our shows by going to your web browser and putting in prn.fm, and then you can listen to the current show that's on air. But you can now download onto your smartphone, Android and iPhone, our PRN browser. Search for it in your app store, and you can listen live to whatever's on at the moment. So download now our PRN.fm app.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Michael Wald, and I'm proud to announce that I'm the host of a new show right here on PRN every Saturday at 1 o'clock entitled Ask the Blood Detective. And as your friendly neighborhood blood detective, I'll be exploring all the cutting-edge, important health topics, which will include everything from foods to technology to supplementation and how it impacts your current health so that you can either reach health, maintain good health, or shoot for optimal health and longevity. But what is different about this show is that I'll be describing and teaching you how to interpret your own laboratory tests to find hidden nutritional and health meaning when many other healthcare providers fail to do so. So tune in with me every Saturday at 1 o'clock. Ask the Blood Detective. See you soon.
PRN would like to thank its listeners for making us number one on Zeno Radio's phone service and also the top searched internet radio station on Google. Thank you for helping us move forward.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining me, I'm talking with Eric Jackson. He is one of the co-founders of the Black Yield Institute, and he is an organizer and educator and filmmaker with the organization. So, Eric, has Lee been able to join us yet or no?
No, unfortunately. We're really in the thick of a busy weekend. We have what we call fall into BYI, which starts today. So we're dealing with some last-minute things with partners.
Okay.
And vendors,
okay,
so we're sorry about that.
That's okay.
I apologize.
Okay, so, Eric, then it will just be you and me. We'll continue. So can you share with us how food apartheid shows up in Baltimore? I know it's an issue there, and that's what you're working with so much. Can you share with us how it actually shows up in Baltimore and then how the Black Yield Institute is actually addressing that?
Sure. So I talked a little bit about it, earlier, but I talked about, the disconnect from ancestral foods, the limited kind of control that people have on what's available in the community. In fact, where our headquarters is in South Baltimore, we have it's a pretty small community, maybe only, four miles long. And if, folks know anything about Baltimore, it's noted as a city of neighborhoods. And so this community or neighborhood is a historically Black community where all of the people who own food retail businesses are non-Black shopkeepers and business owners. So it shows up in that way. It shows up in, how far people actually have to travel to get good food. And while we're working on developing a grocery store, a cooperatively owned grocery store in this in the region, not just in the community. This community actually hasn't had a grocery store for about 15 years. And granted, I've been around for all of that, not just because I'm older than 15, but because I actually grew up in this community. So it shows up in those ways. It shows up in so many ways, in the subtle ways, as I talked about earlier, where our elders are passing early. My father, I talked about my grandmother, but my father, who also is an inspiration to me and who I hope our work is honoring, he passed at 47 years old, very young, from heart disease. And so, when I think about my children, my wife and I have four children, from 13 to 2, and only two of my children even remember my father. Now, we talk about him, but remember him, his presence, what that meant. That's how food apartheid shows up. Folks are not able to, when you talk about recipes and cooking, what about those things that should be passed down that are not, because we don't have that time. So the premature deaths and the high incidences of disease. There are many ways, and I could write a whole dissertation about it, but those are just some of the ways that that food apartheid shows up in Baltimore and in this area. And so the way that we are attempting to address all of these issues around controlling how we define food, controlling how we tell our narratives and all, we work out of five different areas. Two of them are place-based, specifically in this community, Cherry Hill, that I talked about in South Baltimore. And we have a farm where we grow food commercially. We have a community garden, and then we also do cultural celebrations and community relationship building in that space. We also are establishing the cooperatively owned grocery store, which we've been working on for the last 2 years, and have, you know, community members actually, you know, pledge, you know, share in this cooperative venture. We also, outside of the specific geographical area, are working on research, recognizing that we need to, you know, tell our own stories. So we're working on an ethnographic research study right now, as well as a food apartheid study in the area. Then we're also doing some action network building, or coalition building. Your listeners may be more familiar with that term. And then we're also doing political education. All of those things for us, we believe that has to be a part of this larger movement building work, not just showing what can happen on the ground with the two, you know, the grocery store effort, you know, specifically cooperatively owned grocery store effort, and then growing our own food and creating space and building with one another on the land. But also we have to build, you know, networks across the city and, you know, educate ourselves and build politically so that we can engage the systems and environment. And then also, like I said, research so we tell our own stories. We need to be able to control the narratives as well, not just those of apartheid, but also what's happening and what how folks have been resilient and resistant and revolutionary over time.
Uh-huh. And has the Black Yield Institute been able to plug into any resources from the city of Baltimore and get any support for some of these areas that you're working hard on, whether, you know, like the grocery store, obviously, yeah, for one. Are there any grants or money to help you in that effort?
And there isn't a whole lot of money. We've gotten some support from one of the city's, quasi-governmental agencies to help support the what we call our readiness study that we did for the first year to see if folks were ready for a cooperatively owned grocery store. But that's one of the challenges that we have locally. We have a lot of moral support and support from city, public servants who help us with, you know, the big grant writing and give their staff time to support us, and we're in partnership. However, there is definitely room for more funds, whether they come through grants or low-interest loans, to support this work. One of my critiques of the city, including those folks who I work with, were very clear about the critique, that the food retail strategy has actually largely been about attracting national chain grocers to come into the city and what I consider outsourcing help rather than doing the work of building infrastructure, capacity, and support to do more insourcing. Because I believe, and maybe I'm just dreamy, but I truly believe that the genius of people who are just backs are against the wall trying to figure out how to make things happen can come up with creative solutions, and sometimes just need a little capital, sometimes need a little, you know, capacity and support. And so I'm working with local agencies to support with that and other grassroots nonprofit organizations about addressing those issues. And then also, like, from a policy, I mean, not just legislative, but from a policy standpoint, also with urban agriculture, so that folks secure more land, that they actually have security on land and not just have it, but also water access. But those are kind of the higher level policy issues that we've been talking with folks about and pushing so that we can actually be successful in what we're attempting to do and create models that can be inspirational, that can be replicated where necessary, and that can just, if nothing else, do what we wanted to do, and that is to meet the needs of our people.
Uh-huh. Now, I know you said you will shop at Whole Foods. How far is a Whole Foods market or another good market from where you live? Like, how far, difficult is it for people to get there?
From where I live? So from where I live, my family and I, we shop at a couple of different markets when we're not getting our food from, you know, our farm and our partner farms. Maybe about 3 or so miles from where we are, and it's actually in Harford County, which is a county that is adjacent to where I live in Northeast Baltimore City. And the reason why, so I want to be clear that the closest grocery store is, I mean, maybe a quarter of a mile, but the closest quality grocery store is that 3 miles away that we go to. Some of your, you know, chains, chain grocery stores that we go to, because the quality is different, the prices are different, and we're privileged to have two vehicles, actually, and so we're able to go and get what we need to supplement. But, yeah, I mean, where we live, we have two nice-sized grocery stores, but the quality just isn't good, and they don't always have the products that we want as a family. And then where I work in Cherry Hill, which, again, in South Baltimore, a different region of the city, it's actually the actual closest grocery store is about 2.5, close to 3 miles away. And by car, you may be able to get there in about 7-10 minutes. For those who have to, you know, take a bus, that might be about just like transferring and things, like, you know, over an hour, you know, to get to the grocery store. So,
wow, right.
Yeah.
Right, not doable. And do the grocery stores deliver? Like, if you were to go there, you know, if you were to take that schlep of an hour to do the grocery shopping, would they then deliver to your neighborhood, or will they not deliver?
They don't. I mean, we have, like, you know, some of the other delivery services that actually will deliver, and it was very interesting that I saw that over the, you know, last couple of years, Peapod and other, you know, delivery services. And let me be clear, that's no by no means an advertisement. I try not to use that, but those kind of delivery services. But no, I mean, the grocery stores that are actually close, that are either in the city limits, that's the example that I just shared, that's about you know, almost 3 miles away. Then there's another that's about 4 miles away that's also in another county. Those are not necessarily like your big chain restaurants. Those are the smaller ones, the, you know, kind of the second tier or the B-rate, you know, ones, or the wholesalers.
No, because Whole Foods by us, you know, advertises, you know, 2-hour delivery. You know, it's like, you know, you can just call on the phone and get your, or not call on the phone, place an order
and
online.
I mean, you can. That's also expensive, you know. So it's like the question between, like, you know, do they deliver or do I want them to deliver because it's going to cost an arm and a leg? Like, all right, well, I'll just travel for it, you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, catch a ride or something like that. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So do you see, is there a role for white folks within this food sovereignty movement that you are working so diligently on? Is there a role that white people can play to assist the Black Yield Institute and the issues that you're grappling with, or is it really that, you know, the white folks have created the problem and so they really can't be of any help? Where do you see that?
No, so my politics personally and our politics at Black Yield Institute are such that we believe, as I talked about earlier, that because we are the ones directly impacted by the issues, we have to be the ones who are at the helm of leading the work in terms of setting the goals, our measurements, the ways in which we go about doing it, the approaches, and all of those things. But I think that there's a role for white folks, and that role is not an active. Well, isn't it? It's an active one, but first, it's not active. First, it should be. It should be about contemplation, right? So first, recognizing, you know, doing that deep inner work to figure out, okay, do I want to contribute to Black liberation in this way? And one, why? And what has white privilege afforded me? And what resources have come out of that? Whether they be certain knowledges, certain experiences, networks, resources, whatever they might be, what am I, what do I have to give? And then also finding out if there is an organization, and in the case of Black Hill Institute, having a one-on-one meeting, being human together, and be relate with one another to figure that out, is what we don't want, and I don't want personally. White guilt can't help us get to any sense of liberation through Black land and food sovereignty. I don't believe that that's possible. No guilt can get us there, not just white guilt. But I think that there's a role, but folks have to do that soul-searching, if you will, that introspection. And I think once that happens and folks authentically want to contribute without having feeling guilty, but because their liberation is tied with our liberation, then I think that that's a way for us to be in community with one another in ways that make sense. And that is a little more situational, because that entails an assessment of, okay, well, who do you know, and what have you. And so thus far, I mean, we have white folks who contribute by giving money. We have white folks who contribute by being volunteers or serving on our Circle of Wise Council, which is our name for our board. We've had at least one or two white folks who have served in that capacity. But just like there are ways for folks to be in community. It might be connecting us with a network of folks, or having us come to this conference, or hiring us to do certain things. I think there are different roles, but that I think it has to happen through that soul searching and that real relationship building, so that we so that is the essence of the relationship, a very humanizing one, because this work has to be humanizing. It's political.
Well, I personally want to thank you for the work you're doing, because it is so important, and it is so important to mobilize people to come together to work on these issues. And I think the no guilt thing is an excellent motto to stand by, because that's not going to get us anywhere. And I think the middle path, like the Buddha said, no one can get liberated until everyone's liberated. So thank you. I will share your contact info on my website for everybody, for the Black Yield Institute, because we are out of time. As you can hear, my music is coming on. But, Eric, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning, and good luck at the conference. I don't know if I'm going to make it down there, but if I don't, I hope I meet you another time.
All right. Thank you so much. This was a great opportunity. Be well, and thank you.
You're welcome. And everybody out there that's joined us, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Bye for now, and have a great weekend.